Right.
He got him real comfortable, and then he started
Right.
kind of getting deep.
The last time I was interviewed, and you guys may have looked at that, or I know Lexi said he looked at it.
Yeah.
That was a little uncomfortable because I was working for the federal government when that happened. And in fact, they actually changed a couple of things I said on that interview to
Who
keep
said
me out of
they?
trouble.
Oh, the
The
people
person
who
who was
interviewed.
interviewing me, she only changed one of the two things. But I had to be relatively diplomatic because I knew it was going to get on the web
Right.
and that anybody could see it. And now I don't care. You
Right.
can ask me about anything.
Okay.
Well, yeah. That I know about.
Yeah. Yeah. Stefan Rosenzweig.
Yeah, that's good.
Was
Zweig.
Zweig.
It's good.
You say it once.
Zweig.
All right. There is a L O a lot of A D advantages to not being able to talk. You don't have to repeat people's names and get them
You don't have to
right.
remember.
I'm good like as soon
Okay,
as you say it, but not,
right.
have 2 minutes go
I'm terrible.
by
I have
and
senior
it's
moments
gone.
and names. Faces don't disappear. They never do. I think I may have met Frank 30 years ago, and I don't really know where. But I knew Frank when I first saw him, because well, I've been around this area for 40 years, so and so is Frank. But he was very familiar, but I couldn't remember his name. And then when Alexi told me, "Oh, Frank Moore," said first it didn't mean anything. And then when I went on the website, because I did look. I said, "Oh, I know who that is. I know who that person is." Yeah.
And there is a D O double in Berkeley, Hale Zukas, who has a similar, he has same coloring as
Right.
Frank, the same disability, and
Right.
he's in a chair with a board and a pointer.
Right. Okay.
But, in some
I
ways, he doesn't
yes.
look anything like Frank,
I,
but
no no
that,
no, I've seen Frank. I know what Frank looks like. It's yeah, I'm not confused about it. I mean, a number of years ago I represented a young man who, from outward appearance looked like, as a lawyer, looked like Frank. I mean, he had that kind of thing. And yeah, it was all about the school's refusal to provide him with any kind of communication device. Yeah.
Our yeah, we've been going. We've been going. Yeah.
Okay, that's fine.
Yeah. Where were you when I C was G R growing up? All the fights that Frank had to fight growing up.
I bet. I bet. Because you're my age. I'm 60 also. I'm 62. Man, you're a young man. I'm an old man. I'm 62. But I know how people with disabilities were treated. When I was a kid, they were pretty much closeted away. And unfortunately, in so many parts of the country, I mean, this kid I was representing, and this was in Florida 10 years ago, but he was literally closeted. I mean, they had him in the school, but they literally put the kid in the closet, and he hadn't really learned anything. And then he was about 21 years old, and they were kicking him out. And we got him back in, and we got him some communication devices that helped him, because there was a person inside, the body, and the person was not being allowed by the school district to get out. And I know how people were treated. I mean, growing up in New York City, and you never saw people with disabilities in the schools. They were sent somewhere.
P my M O My mom always fought. D-A, Dad was in the Air Force. So every time we moved, there was another fight to get Frank into the school system.
It was a struggle every single time. Your mother must have been a wonderfully remarkable, or maybe still is, strong,
she's passed away, but she's,
caring, wonderful woman. One of the problems I'm sure that she had, though, was making sure when she got there that, you know, whatever happened was, you know, something that was going to be helpful.
Yes.
You know, just getting in school was one thing, and then making sure you had access to everything and the accommodations you need to sort of learn.
And sometimes they did not take me. They wouldn't take you into the school.
Sometimes they wouldn't take you. Yeah. I mean, this is before all the laws, you know. And sometimes even the most motivated parents, they just didn't know what to do. My first wife, my ex-wife, she had a brother who was blind, and they loved him to death, but they did everything for him. Right. So he never learned how to do anything for himself. And, you know, he's about 45 or 50.
Exactly.
Yeah. They did everything for him. I mean, they literally loved him to death. And it really wasn't until the mom had a heart attack and couldn't take care of him, and my ex had to take care of him, and she was in college, that he learned how to do some of the things that he needed to learn. They just took it over everything. I mean, he didn't know how to, you know, open the refrigerator door or wipe his butt. And he could do those things.
Right.
But now, you know, someone who's blind at birth like he was, they have a sense, and these folks can become extremely productive, like Frank's become incredibly productive and do all kinds of stuff,
right.
You know. But so there's been some good changes anyway since from when you went to school. But I did read your resume. I actually read that, and I was looking at it because I was curious. Now, how'd this guy get so accomplished when so many people who are Frank's age didn't have that opportunity? And we're very fortunate here. You know, I lived here for many, many years, and then I went and lived in Florida for 5 years. And it was a different world. You know, no curb cuts even. I mean,
where
things,
in Florida? What city?
Well, I started in Key West, and that was sort of the draw, because Key West is kind of like Berkeley.
Right.
You know, old hippies. And,
F-U. Funny. When I was G, growing up, F, L, Florida was one of the A, D, V, A, advanced S states.
It was one of the advanced states?
As far as disability goes.
Well, it isn't now. I mean, things that we certainly completely take for granted here in California, things like curb cuts, or even sidewalks for that matter. No, seriously. And but given the really elderly population down there, you would think that there would be sidewalks. But in a lot of neighborhoods, there aren't. And so everybody is dependent on getting on the bus or whatever it is that'll take people from the old age home to the shopping mall. You know, just things that, again, this area has been, you know, as you know, the center of disability rights in some ways in the whole United States. And so many activists have come out, like you, have come out of this community, you know, people who really care about people with disabilities. And we take it for granted here. But in a place like Florida, even Key West, which is a very progressive little town, we had a gay mayor when I was living down there, very progressive little town. But you didn't see people in wheelchairs very often. You just didn't see them. It's not like they weren't there. It was just that they were somewhat invisible and being treated badly in institutions. Yeah. So Florida's not so good. A lot of the South is not so good.
Even when I T R I tried to E N T E N R enroll in college after getting S straight A's the G U the guy would not E enroll me because I drooled.
And that was, what, 1970 or 1968?
66.
Okay, yes. And that was very, very commonplace. People, though, still do that in some places. I had a client in Florida who enrolled. He had been a special ed kid, and that was very clear from his diploma. He had taken special ed classes, and he enrolled in a proprietary college. Not even like a university, a proprietary college, and they accepted him. And he showed up for the orientation. And I don't know it was whether he was drooling or what it was, but the president of the school saw him, and he went up to him, and this was not 30 years ago. This was like, well, it was 10 years ago, and said, "We have no accommodations for you." So the parents were smart. They said, "Write me a letter," and they did. So we sued them, and the kid got a bunch of money. But still, I mean, most people don't get to advocates. And, you know...
Did he get into school?
He went somewhere else. He went somewhere else. And I suspect he did very well because he was a smart kid.
Yeah.
Now, that kind of stuff doesn't happen as much anymore at the, you know, the university level. And that's probably one of the few things that when I was... I worked for the Office for Civil Rights in the Department of Ed. And for a few years, we did a lot of accommodations work in colleges and... Got a lot of people, you know, I know you were a trailblazer and other people here in the Bay Area, you know, in terms of educating students with disabilities.
I went over. His head.
There you go. There you go. Did you go to the president of the school or something, or the media?
The dean.
The dean. All right.
Who? B. E. C. Became president. Became my A. Advisor.
Yeah. Good. And you made it through college and got your bachelor's degree.
But I E N enjoyed S struggle.
You like that, huh?
Most people don't.
Right.
No, that's true. Avoid it.
No, that's true. That's true. Most people don't want to have to be an advocate to just get the basic necessities of life. And you're a fighter. I mean, you're a fighter. You're somebody who likes to, who enjoys, you know, that fight. But for a lot of people, they need you in their corner.
Fun.
It's fun.
It's fun.
It's fun. Okay. It can be fun. It can be fun. But for a lot of people, it's just something they can't handle, you know, and that's why they need, you know, somebody in their corner to help them out. It's hard. Yeah, it's hard.
Who? Why? Did not you G O go for the B I for the B U the Bucks? Why didn't you go for the Bucks?
Go for the Bucks? Well, I grew up in a very progressive family. My paternal grandfather was probably an anarchist of some sort who came over from Germany. My father was a union organizer. I grew up in Greenwich Village in New York City in the 40s. And my parents had been active, very, very active.
How was that? Growing up in Greenwich
Village. Oh, I was the luckiest person on earth. I was so fortunate in a lot of ways. I mean, I went to music class with Josh White, you know, very famous, progressive singer in the 40s. I heard the Weavers, when I was a kid. My parents listened to folk music. They took me out. I went to the theater. So it was wonderful. I had, until we moved to the suburbs. And then it wasn't any good because I didn't know how to play baseball or do what the kids in the suburbs did. But I was able to escape and go back into Greenwich Village and sort of hang around with artistic people and political people. So I had a blessed childhood in a lot of ways. I mean, growing up in Manhattan, being around interesting people, very diverse, in all respects. In terms of the Bucks never really occurred to me as something that I was interested in. I wanted to do work that made me feel good and where I felt that I was making a contribution. And that's how I was brought up. So, yeah, I never had any interest in going for the Bucks.
And?
Child of the 60s, too.
Yes.
I came to Berkeley in 1965. I came here because of the free speech movement. Yeah. I was at Cornell in the East and watching TV. Yeah, came out here.
Wanted to.
Yeah.
Wanted to. Yeah. I was in San Bernardino.
Okay.
W.R. writing about the G, the F, R, free speech movement.
Okay. I was watching it on TV, and I said, that's where I want to go to law school. I got to get out of the East Coast, get out of the Ivy League, and I got to go to Berkeley. And I ran down to the law school and talked to a professor who I knew, and he said, yeah, they have a good law school out there. And I applied, and that was it. It was goodbye, New York, and hello, Berkeley. But, yeah, I've always, and the minute I got here, I got involved in the anti-war movement, as most people. That's what was going on here in 1965. And it was extremely exciting because it was like growing up again in some ways.
I was in high school.
Okay.
And one of the FI first HI high school that M mainstreamed.
Oh, wow. That's great. Was that San Bernardino?
It was in Redlands.
Oh, in Redlands.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of next door.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And I W wrote for the school paper.
Wow, that's great.
But Well, Frank wrote anti-war things in the paper, and so here he is, like, he's like the poster child for mainstreaming, and he's all A's and everything. I, even, D. He debated a GI who was in Vietnam.
All right.
And took a lot of heat because people thought that was not okay. My T E, my teacher T told me I was ruining it for all the disabled children that would follow me.
Okay.
This is like a test.
Right. And, well, history has proved her wrong.
Frank said, is not the goal to get C Crips E equal R equal rights.
What Frank was doing was empowering people with disabilities. I mean, that was that's what Frank was doing. Right. He was saying, hey, I'm normal. I can write, you know, but what they were upset about is what you were writing about. And a lot of people were prohibited from writing about it, you know, during the early 70s, I think is when you're probably talking about, or the 60s. It was the 60s, right, if you were in college in the early 70s.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It was quite the opposite. You were helping people. You were showing people that you were, you know, just like everybody else. You could work on the school paper like everybody else, you know.
At B A R radical, you were being a radical.
You were. Absolutely. Well, you were being a human being too. I mean, you know, I mean.
That was my point.
Yes. At the time, being a human, just being a human being was radical. And that's what you were doing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a shame that it's perceived that, it has to be perceived that way. But you were opening the door. You were opening the door for lots of other children. Lots of other children in schools, you know, who wanted to participate fully, you know, in the program. And you were saying, hey, I can do this. You know, I'm going to ride that wherever I want, too.
At that time, C, R, Crips were S, U, supposed to, W, right, R, E, L, I, religious.
Oh, you were supposed to be doing religious tracts because you were so fortunate to be in school that God had blessed you or something.
Or I and inspirational pieces.
Oh, inspirational pieces. I see. Okay. you were the poster child because you were mainstream, so you were going to be the inspiration to all the... Yeah, right. Okay. You showed them, didn't you? You showed them, didn't you, Frank? You did. I mean, you showed them that, you know, that, you know, hey, I don't want to be inspiration. I just want to be like everybody else, right? I got a First Amendment right, and you knew what it was.
They see you are cursed the day they gave me my pointer. He had to fight for the pointer.
You had to fight for the pointer.
They
okay.
wanted him to be normal and use his fingers to type.
I see. Okay.
It was my idea, the pointer.
Mm-hmm.
But he couldn't get anybody to actually make him one
right.
because they didn't want him to look weirder than he already looked.
Okay. Okay. Well, what the next step was, I think, like the kid I worked with, because then they started to give kids pointers, but now they're computers. Now, for some people, the computer can work better than the pointer. For others, it can't. But that wasn't even an option that the district was giving to this boy. He could move his hand well enough to use the computer. He didn't use the pointer particularly well. He didn't quite have the flexibility in his head. This is a boy who had been in a terrible car accident, just a horrible car accident, and it had learning disabilities to begin with. And so he could use the computer though, and they wouldn't give it to him. And we got that for him, you know. But you are the kind of person that opened the door. When I, that's all I'm trying to say. To so many kids now, who are being, you know, hopefully educated. It's not all of them, but a lot more.
Why would not they give him a computer?
Money. Money. I have very cynical views too about things like this, but a lot of it was just money. A fear that if they buy this child a boy a computer, and the minute they agreed to a computer, I wanted two computers. Well, that's because he's at home and he's in school, and unless they could have a computer that he could travel with. And this is actually before laptops became as, you know, common as they are now. And I don't even know if he could have used a laptop, to tell you the truth. I'm not sure. He could use a mouse, sort of, but I don't know if he could use a laptop.
P
It was money.
L I P L I no P I no L I T T little K
Little keys.
little
Little
keys
laptops that are kind of small
laptops the
and
keys are so
yeah,
small that
right.
might also
That's
be a
right. That's
problem.
right. That's right. That's right. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. But that's right. Yeah. I think it's partly money. I mean, my cynical view is that, you know, if we educated everybody, and that includes people with disabilities and people of color, and if we did, then there'd be real competition for the jobs in this world, and they don't want
Yes.
that. The people
Yes.
that control the world. We need people. You know, I don't, you know, to not be productive in our
I
society.
and then P E people would not be I isolated.
That's right. That's right.
All
That's right.
people.
That's right. That's right. I mean, right now, for example, we have this whole high stakes testing program. You got to pass a test to get a high school diploma. And we know that people with disabilities, we know that people for whom English is a second language, we know that African Americans, we know they have difficulty with high stakes tests and that they're going to be screened out in the process. Everybody knows this. But we allow this to go on as a society. And so then why do we do this? Well, what's the answer? And I think that the answer is that the George Bushes of this world are very fearful that if everyone gets, you know, the power and people are not isolated any longer and that people can group together, changes will come.
Yeah, E, exactly.
No,
Yeah.
that's. But we get played against each other. You know, they'll play the kids with disabilities off in the school district against the kids who have language, you know, or the African American kids against both of the other groups, you know.
Oh. Oh. You don't want to be in S P E special ed
Right.
then
Right.
P people will think you are a M R, a retard.
That's right. That's right. It's a really unfortunate, because, I mean, I believe 100% in mainstreaming. I also know that there are some children who need a few extra things. It should happen in a regular classroom, you know, whatever those things are. But the label, you know, the special ed label often can haunt you through your education.
E, especially. No, ES. T. H. Esther. Oh, the woman who's going to be a guest on here. What about her? She was. She, see? Oh, she came from the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
Did not speak any English.
Right.
And was thrown into the public school system.
Right.
S. O. So, she. H. Had. S. P. Special. E. Ed. She had special ed.
Right.
W. H. I. Which. M. Meant. She. Was. Not. C. H. A. Challenged.
Right. That's right. Well, she didn't need a special ed program. She needed a language program. She needed how to learn how to speak English, and she needed to learn the subject matter. She didn't need to be in special ed. In the late 60s, a lawsuit was filed against the state for misclassifying students who spoke Spanish and putting them in classes for the retarded, you know, special ed classes. And it's a problem that still exists. I mean, it still exists, particularly, you know, where she's from the Philippines. That, you know, Spanish doesn't happen as much because they have many more Spanish-speaking teachers. But teachers who speak Tagalog or, you know, whatever the primary language of your friend was, you know, they don't have that benefit. And they misclassified her. She shouldn't be put in special ed because she doesn't speak English. She doesn't have a disability.
She was C. L. A. Classified as S. Slow.
Right. That's right.
She's and
it happened to
smart.
Tens of thousands, if not millions, of children in this country. And this is with the work I've done. This is the kind of stuff I've done for the last 40 years.
In fact, my brother had the same thing happen. R. E. A. Really, he, H, had, it, M, much harder than you did.
Mm-hmm.
He's not physically disabled.
Right. Okay. The students who actually have it the worst are students who have disabilities and don't understand English. And I worked with a lot of kids like that over the years. Because just finding teachers who, you know, understand and can work with someone, you know, who has a disability and also doesn't have, you know, English yet. And the whole school system, rather than seeing, you know, the other language, for example, as that's a good thing. Let's work on that. Let's you know, develop Tagalog when you learn English. And then you'll be bilingual, and that's a great thing. And that's an advantage in our society, but that's not what the school district does. And a child who's disabled, and I worked with a number of kids like this, you know, and my goal was always finding the teacher who cared about the kid,
right.
Period. Because other, you know, but finding somebody who was really qualified, you know, to work with students like that is a real challenge. And there are more and more students like that. You know, I don't know if you know this, but more than 25% of the kids in California schools don't speak English. 25%, that's a lot. That means, you know, if we're in a schoolroom, one of us is, you know, not English proficient. So that's a tremendous number of kids. And a lot of them are kids with disabilities. Like, disability cuts across, you know, all the groups. So we got a lot of work to do.
Is it G O going B backwards?
I'm afraid that a lot of things are going backwards in this world. You know, yes. Yes. I mean, I can't even read the newspaper. I mean, I get so upset. I mean, I think, you know, we're spending all of our money on war, and we're not dealing with the issues that people need to have dealt with.
The E X I T exit E X A exam was J U just okayed in the C O U
court, the court of appeal.
In the court.
Yeah,
yes.
Just the other day. I saw that yesterday. I think it was. Yeah.
Yes.
I saw that. Yes. And it's going to continue to separate people. And what it's going to say to a lot of students with disabilities and students who don't have English and African American students, it's basically going to say, well, I might just as well drop out because I'm not going to get my diploma. And there are a lot of reasons why kids don't do well on these tests. I mean, there are a lot of reasons. But one of the reasons that people are just beginning to look at is psychological. It's psychological. And they've done some research with African Americans, for example. And they've looked at African American students at Stanford. Really smart kids. They got into Stanford, right? But they don't do as well on the tests. And the way students have put it to the psychologists is, when I go in and take the test, I know that I have the whole race is on my shoulders. You know, like, you were going to be the model, you know, student with disabilities. Student with disabilities goes in there. They know that they're going to, what we call, disaggregate the data. They're going to look at how the disabled kids did. They're going to look at how, you know, the English language learners are doing, and this and that. And that is an additional pressure. And there's a psychologist at Stanford, a very well-known professor there, who's actually seen the blood pressure goes up in students in a high-stakes situation. So a lot of kids fail it because they freak, basically. You know, they freak. And it's not because they don't know the material. So but it's a weapon in a lot of ways. It's a weapon to keep people from succeeding in society. I know I'm becoming cynical about it, but I really think it's true.
H E hey in they are R I right they are
right. They are right.
They don't want me.
That's right. That's basically right. They don't want you. And I want you and they want you. You have friends and family. But the society at large would just as well forget about large segments of people. And not completely. For example, it's okay for Mexican Americans to pick fruit. You know, and that, you know, do the really hard work in our society, and then we'll kick them out of the country and they'll go home. You know, we want people to a certain extent.
C R Crips 2 I N inspire.
Right. Well, say it again, Frank. I didn't get it.
Wait, you said they want Mexicans, for example, but to pick
that's
the fruit
right.
and leave. And
that's
they,
right.
Frank said, and they want Crips, but just to inspire.
You. Just to inspire
so they put
people.
Just, this
no,
is
that's right. That's yeah. right. You know, you see the telethon on TV.
Right.
You know, Jerry Lewis or whoever that clown is, you know, with the poor little kid, and let's send some, you know, let's be an inspiration. And that's the role. That's the role.
At, to, have, some, one, two, M, A, make, you, feel, S, you, superior.
That's right. You feel good. Because you know that you're a whole human being, right. And there are other people who aren't, so you feel like you're better than those people.
Like, yet, W, A, L, walk. Walking is O, obviously, much better than being in a wheelchair, not being able to walk.
Well, but what society ignores are the gifts that people have. I'm looking at this picture. I couldn't do that in a million years. Now I know it's Patti Smith, who I love, but I couldn't do that in a million years.
And if the G O, the goal is to get F R O from A to B. What is the D difference? If you walk or if you ride in a wheelchair.
Well, you'll get there faster probably if that's an electric wheelchair. I think that's the difference. No, it doesn't make any difference at all. But for so many years, we were almost taught to feel uncomfortable around people with disabilities. I remember when I was in school, they would bring in someone who was the exemplar of people with disabilities. And, you know, address the auditorium. But the reality in the school was there was no mainstreaming at all. And the students just simply weren't there.
Like, where? Oh, where Erica? Erica is the director of enrichment at the Claremont Retirement Home in Oakland. It's a large retirement community. And they have, I guess, which is fairly common, they have the assisted living people,
right.
And then they have the independent people, and they're all, they have different floors, but, and different dining rooms, but it's all, well, so there's been a movement to not have the assisted living people eat in the main dining room, because it makes the people that are independent uncomfortable seeing somebody who needs help with their food or whatever.
Right.
And
right.
B, E, because they may be next.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think that's absolutely right. And you put it much more bluntly than I was going to put it. I think that's absolutely what it is. No one wants to sort of see. Of course, these people are getting older and, you know, they're going to pass away. And so out of sight, out of mind, you don't want to recognize. I know I had an aunt who is about 90 in one of these facilities, and it's a very, very nice facility. And then there was a locked door. Okay. And that's where the Alzheimer's patients were and the people who just didn't have very long. And it was completely segregated in that respect. And I know it was just to make the people who were more able, you know, more comfortable. They didn't want to see what the reality was. You know, they might become less able. That's crazy. I mean, I think.
B, E, because it, S, E, T, sets us up.
Right. That's right. That's right.
If all people A R, no, A-T, A-T, 8, in one dining room, then there would not be S U such F fear.
Right. That's right. That's right. The uncertainty, when things become more real, the fear disappears, I think. I would hope.
But I, no, and if you S C you will not be L O locked away.
Right.
What?
Right.
It makes it less scary. Yeah.
I think that's right. It does make it less scary. I find the whole. I really hope that I'm never in assisted living in a way. The whole notion of senior housing even freaks me out. I can't perceive of living somewhere where there weren't at least some children running around screaming.
BR. No, BT, by the way, would it be legal to ban the assisted living people from the main dining room?
Would it be legal? Oh, probably. I mean, is it more? You didn't ask me whether it's moral or not, but it's probably legal for them. First of all, it's a private institution, or not?
Yes.
It's a private institution. Even in a public institution, though, the same things go on.
T. E. Tell. Don't tell them that.
I won't. take that out. Take that out, Mike. I mean, you know, the law's an ass, and the law's a little box. It's a very small box, and you have, you know, a few rights in this little box, and it's not particularly expansive, and it's often immoral. It's one of the reasons that I'm very pleased that I'm not doing that kind of work right now any longer, because the box is getting smaller. You asked before, are things getting worse? Yes, they are. They are. Well, I think in all respects, this is the worst time in my life in terms of what's going on in the country. We have the worst federal government. Look at the state government. And, you know, we elected Ron Dellums, and I'm glad, in Oakland, where I live. But he doesn't have anything to work with. You know, that's his problem. I mean, he'd like to do a lot of good things, but mayors and cities don't have stuff to work with. All the money is channeled into Washington. And all the money is going into war, I'm afraid, and so-called defense, and everybody's. I mean, the notion that we have a poor school system, we don't have enough money in the school system, to me is just, it's unbelievable. And we're the richest country in the world, but we're not putting our money where our alleged values, you know, are, where our Constitution really is. We're making richer people rich, richer. I mean, it's. That's what's going on.
Ken, no. Even if B-E-R-B-E-T-T, better education would M-A make for B E better E M employment. Better education would make for better employment.
Right. No, that's right.
E M P employers No, employees would make for better employees.
That's true on a lot of levels. But what it means is that the CEO's son or daughter wouldn't necessarily be as qualified as, you know, the student with disabilities who was really educated, or the black kid who was really educated, and the rest. And I think that's what it's about. I really think it's almost as simplistic as that. There are just so many, and things are getting worse. I mean, when I moved here, I lived in North Berkeley, well, Solano. That was a working class neighborhood. Mm. People went and they worked in factories, and they owned little homes. Mm. That class of people had been wiped out. Mm. I mean, there really aren't that many opportunities anymore. They talk about, well, there are more jobs, but they're not jobs that anybody wants to do. They're jobs in service industries and hotels and in restaurants. And the competition for real jobs and slots at the university and all the rest. And people have become really angered. You know, they've been turned against each other, and people have been angered. And where do they turn? To you, you know, and to these other kids. And they're very fearful. People are very fearful about, you know, will my kid be able to get ahead in this world? And it brings out the worst in people, you know, when they believe that there are real shortages. And education now is a shortage. I mean, it's like not everybody is going to get it. But those who get it, sure, they're going to make better employees, which is one of the reasons I think women have succeeded relatively well. Because I think corporations have realized that there was a tremendous talent pool out there, you know. And you know, right now, for example, there are more women going to college and to law schools than there are men. And the men are very freaked out about that. They're talking about ways to get more men into school, which I think is kind of funny. But no, that's really true. Believe it or not, that's really true. I mean, they are. They're concerned about white men. What's happening to the poor white male? Can't get into college anymore. You know, I was just up at the law school with my nephew. I went to the law school here at Berkeley, and he's thinking about going there. And 59% of the entering class at Bolt Hall Law School are women. So now the men are all freaked out. But part of the freaked outedness is there still is a glass ceiling for women. There's no question about it. Even though 60% of the women in law school, very few partners in law firms are women. There's still a glass ceiling. But there is some entry level. And you're absolutely right. If everybody got educated, we have a much smarter, a better workforce. And the problem is that we don't reward people for valuable work in our country. You know, when my parents were younger, and when there was a, you know, people could get money for singing or for their art, you know, during World War II. You know, you could be an artist and get paid. Now you got to beg a foundation for a grant, and it's very, very difficult. We don't recognize those kinds of intellectual accomplishment and reward them at all. It's just making money. And the people who have the money want to keep it. That's the bottom line. They want to keep it. They don't want to give it to anybody else.
What if I was B.O.R. born in the 60s? No, in the 70s. Mm-hmm. Would I have been able to accomplish what you've accomplished?
I think, assuming you had the same mom, okay, who really pushed for you, I think you would have had more opportunities if you were born in the 70s than you were born in the 40s. But again,
what about the 80s?
I think each generation there have been some changes, but I think one of the differences is we were born and sort of came of age at a time when people really saw possibilities. And I think that certainly for you, you saw possibilities and you decided, I'm going to fight, you know, when you were in high school to write what you wanted to write.
R I S risk. You were willing to risk to get the possibility.
Yeah, because you weren't risking much because you weren't getting much. But and I think that maybe for kids born in the 70s or 80s, there might be more of a fear factor and more of a sense. I mean, we had a sense, I had a sense, and I think you did too, because I've read enough about what you've written and I'm listening to you tonight. And my sense is that, you know, we had a sense of communalism and we could really change things,
yes,
and, you know, and all the rest. And I think the generations you're talking about, my kids, I have two daughters and they're like 35. Mm-hmm. And they had some of that sense, but not nearly as much as as we did. And the reason for that is the realities that they saw around them. We didn't deal with realities. I didn't deal with realities. I really thought that by the time I was 60, at the very least, we would have legalized marijuana, for God's sakes. You know, that we would have learned something from Korea and Vietnam, that, you know, we would have made some progress. I think we've made some bit of progress. But we had the sense that, you know, we were going to change the world. And in some ways, some of us did.
You did. You did.
Right. Right.
I did.
Yep. That's right. And so many of us did. So many of us did. But when I look at Alexi, someone you know, and he's doing it too. But when I meet most folks of his generation, they're trying to get over. They're trying to get by. You know, when I got out of school, there were more jobs. Progressive jobs. There was sort of a war on poverty. We could be cynical about it, but it did employ a lot of people. It managed, people could make a living and be an activist for the first time, you know, in our generation. You know, I know you've had differences with some of the advocacy groups, but you know, but you remember how many people there were working in like a CIL, you know, back in the day. And, you know, they were on both sides of the street. And there were a lot of people involved in a lot of different activities. And I think a lot of that has sort of dropped by the wayside, I'm afraid.
Why?
Why? Maybe because it was successful in some level. And you know, people really don't want people with disabilities to be visible and to be out there. Despite, you know, all these laws we've passed that say that we believe in civil rights, I think for most people, what they believe in is, I don't know what they believe in, but I don't think it goes nearly as far as we want it, you know, to go. They still want you to be an example. You know, you said it yourself. I mean,
yes,
they want
yes.
you to be an example, not just another person.
T-O. Token.
Token. That's right. Token. That's right. That's right. Not completely integrated in our society.
S-P-E. Special.
That's right. That's right. And what we don't do, and we don't do this for any kids in schools, for example, we don't look at their gifts. You know, we diminish them. One of the reasons I got into education work was when I was in junior high, they lined all the kids up in music class. And they went, oh, well, you're a bass and you're a soprano. And then they pointed to me and they said, you're a listener.
Oh,
and here I was, you know, and I thought I was going to be a rock and roll star. I never did. I mean, although my mom played the piano, I loved music from the time I was a little kid. I always loved music, still do. Thank you. And you guys do too. And that's one of the reasons I like you guys so much. I always loved music. They told me I was a listener. And so I didn't even get to open my mouth.
Wow.
I could have been Tom Waits or something. I don't know how to write either. But
S.
His voice is no worse than mine.
STI. L. Still. You still could. Still
That's
can.
Right. That's right. And one of the things now that I'm doing, now that I'm retired, is, for example, I never learned how to use tools. Never learned how to do anything. So I watch Alexi. You know, you got Alexi in my house. So I've been watching. Been watching what he does. And it's new for me. And I've been his gopher. I've been running around and getting parts for him. And I'm learning about it.
H. E. Hey. I. G. Got. Him. You got Alexi. His T training.
Right. I think I
Alexi
heard
Alexi had never picked up a tool either.
Right. He told me that. Yeah. He told me that. And and you knew Jim, right? And Jim
would just trust Frank.
Right.
Frank said
that's right.
Alexi needs to learn how to be do that. And he took him on and trained him.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, everyone who is in school should have an opportunity, this is my view, to whatever gifts they have, let's try to develop them. But that's not what we're doing.
For A, J, O, joke, they, in, college, I, took, A, painting class.
Mm-hmm.
And the teacher told Frank that, was it a he or a she? He, that he could not critique Frank's work because he can't critique someone who doesn't do his art with his hands.
Well, he was just showing his own disability to you. I mean, he wasn't able. I mean, he wasn't competent at his,
I always K knew that.
Right. Yeah. That's right. That's right. No, I think that we don't have that. You know, he had no expectations. He was in a box. You know, art is produced by someone who moves their hand with a brush and goes blah, blah, blah. Not somebody who has something like that. You know, it's...
In, is, not, it, what, is, on the canvas.
That's right. That's right.
Not how it got there.
Right. Right. That's right. It's what's on the canvas. It's as simple as that. I mean, I don't know much about art, but I know what I like, and I don't care how it got on the canvas. It doesn't make any difference to me at all. Or on my walls at home or whatever, you know. You either like it or you don't like it.
No. I mean. L. O, G, I, no logic. There was no logic to that at all.
That's right. That's right. There's no logic at all in discrimination based on disability or based on what language you speak or whatever. Yeah. Or Jesse Jackson speak a few years ago, and he said that Jesus didn't speak English. And it's true. Jesus, I don't know what language Jesus spoke, but I can assure you it was not English. But yet there are millions of people that think he was God, but he didn't speak English. And there's all these people that think he was God, he didn't speak English. Well, what does that say to us? You know, Christians? I mean, what does it say to us? I mean, we make assumptions about people. You know, we make assumptions. Your Filipino friend, we make an assumption.
He was not a C. H. Christian, either. Jesus.
That's right. That's right. It's one of my people. The Jewish person. <Right. laughs> No, that's absolutely right. But we have low expectations. But it's about fear. It's about fear. I guess if everybody decided that, well, art can be produced in ways other than, and people have. I mean, I saw an artist, a movie about an artist who paints with his feet. And it's extraordinary. You probably know. You may even know this person. I don't know, because it was a documentary that was shown around quite a lot a few years ago. And he got painted with his feet. And it was extraordinary what this person did. And like you say, that's the final product, not how it got there.
I A N piano. that you play. Frank plays the piano. That's he jammed with this with these musicians
last
night.
That's sensational.
And they were so excited about it, they want to fly out here and book studio time to do a recording with Frank.
Right. There you go. Yeah. There you go. Yeah. But, you know, art is, music and art are one place, though. Obviously, this teacher didn't have a clue. But music and art is one place where people have been able, some people at least, have been able to sort of move out and say, yes, I'm a human being, too. The word, yes. I do want to say one thing. I don't know how late we're getting, but one thing I do want to say before I leave.
We got
like
plenty
the work,
of time.
The work that you guys have done with sexuality, I think, is extraordinary. I used to teach at Laney College back in the late 60s, and we had something called the Experimental College. Did you ever go over there to Laney?
That is W.A. Way
before that's right, that's before Frank got here. Yeah, that's before you got here. Well, we had the Experimental College, and there was a course offered on sexuality and people with disabilities. And basically the way it worked was any course could be offered if students signed up for it. I taught like a street law class, you know, what happens if the cops come up and blah 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 and that kind of thing. We had a class in making domes and yurts, and there was this class. And of all the classes that were there, the campus left us alone pretty much, but people freaked out about that one class. It went on. I don't remember who the teacher was anymore. It went on. And but that was something that people really freaked out about. You know, it's one thing, you know, for you not to be a spokesperson, but it's even worse if you're having sex and enjoying it, you know. I mean, that's really scary stuff, you know.
CIL banned Frank. And this was, you're talking about that what event in the 80s, or no, it was in the 90s.
Uh-huh.
It was in the 90s. This guy, an artist, a dancer, uh-huh. was given the job of putting together an event about sexuality and eroticism disability. He was a Crip, a disabled guy who was mm-hmm. a dancer.
Right.
And so he's putting this thing together, and he's going, well, it's got to have Frank Moore in it.
Right.
So he gives us a call and gets together with Frank.
Okay.
And Frank said, are you sure that they're going to let me be in this?
Right.
And he said, they gave me carte blanche.
Right.
They said, I can book anybody.
Right.
Frank said, I'm not sure about that. Right. So he said, well, I want you in, but okay, I'll check with them. So he gives us a call and he says, well, you were right. I have carte blanche except for you. We're not allowed in.
But they were afraid about their grants and stuff like that, I bet. Huh?
I was to R A radical.
Radical. Yeah, you were too radical. Remember, you know, the whole Berkeley campus, the one thing that, you know, during the anti-war struggle, the one thing that people tended to focus on were a few people that, you know, I can't remember what the organization was called anymore, but a few people who were sort of into free love and didn't wear clothing on campus. And that seemed to freak people out even worse than, you know, People's Park or anything like that. We've always been very puritanical. And I suspect that CIL was being puritanical in a lot of ways and not wanting to sort of be as radical as you were. Because I think that back then, yeah, on some level, they did want to be models. But you know.
I was S.A. saying things like. You're talking about the beginning when in the mid 70s when mm-hmm. Frank moved here, he was talking about this was like during the whole independent thing. And he said, use your friends. It deepens the relationship. And that was like that was
they
the
didn't
beginning.
Like that?
Oh, no. They didn't want to have anything to do with him. That was completely not OK to think like that. And then, of course, we were told that it kind of switched around mm-hmm. at a certain point.
Right.
And then that was.
Right.
The way people were talking about it.
Well, I guess every movement has, you know, people with really serious, you know, differences. That's a piece of it that I don't know. And I know some of these people who you know too, so we probably shouldn't go into territories, you know. You know, I mean, the people I knew, they were chaining themselves to the federal building and doing that.
N-O. Now. They. W. No, S. Say. I was, I am, A, H, I, historical.
You're an historical figure.
Historical figure, a trailblazer.
A trailblazer.
They say he was doing art as a person before they thought of themselves as a human being, let alone as an artist.
Right.
And
right.
He opened the door for people.
Right. Right.
So they
were very
now.
Nuts and bolts. I remember they were fixing wheelchairs, you know, early on. They had a little wheelchair factory. I got involved doing special ed advocacy for kids with them, you know, way back. But yeah, they were very traditional in a lot of ways. They were a very traditional organization. Not radical. Not radical.
E. D. Ed. Roberts
right.
liked, yeah, Ed Roberts liked Frank and liked Frank's work.
I'm sure he did. I met him a couple of times. I had the privilege of meeting Ed Roberts a couple of times, and I'm sure he would like Frank. He was a radical guy, too.
the people below him that were under him
didn't get it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I can understand why he would like you. I mean, I no difficulty at all. I mean, Ed Roberts was a groundbreaker here at Berkeley. I mean, he was, I think, the first person to get a doctorate and live on campus. And he was an extraordinary human being. And he's somebody, you know, he had to make, you know, I'm sure, you know, make some sacrifices to his politics to kind of get where he was. I mean, he, you know, he managed to get to Sacramento running agencies. You know, you got to put on a tie occasionally to do those kinds of things. But he was a revolutionary guy in a lot of ways, and someone who really saw potential. And, you know, I think all people with disabilities, just an extraordinary human being. And I'm not surprised. There were other people there who I suspect were a lot more uptight. In fact, I know I'm a lot more uptight because I know some of the people there, and just like people, you know, people who are not disabled are uptight. There are a lot of uptight people there too, you know.
His L E T T his letter. Did not do M much to at R E H rehab. Oh, he wrote a letter for you to help you with rehab, and it didn't pull much weight.
Okay.
when he was the G H head of what was that? Was
Department
that his position? The head of the Department of Rehabilitation.
Yeah.
Oh, he wrote
when
you
Jerry
a letter
Brown
when
was
he
governor,
was the head of, and that didn't even pull any weight in the local rehab office.
Well, there's often not a trickle down in bureaucracy because bureaucrats stay the same. That's one of the things I discovered in the federal government. It really doesn't matter who's up there. The bureaucracy does have a tendency to sort of stagnate and stay the same.
That is why getting on, getting in. The S system doesn't really work
Well, it's, you know, you're right, and it's part of the problem, because the system is getting bigger and more controlling.
People always think that if they can get into the system, they can have an effect.
I thought that, at, you know, 10 years ago. I thought that, you know, that if I went to work for the federal government, Bill Clinton was in his last term, he wanted to do things with civil rights, I would be able to do some things. And the reality was really not that at all. I was very disappointed. And you're right, Frank. You're absolutely right.
He did away with welfare.
That's right. He passed the worst legislation that this country ever had. The so-called liberal president, who everybody idolizes now, not me. But there was some. Yeah, you're absolutely right. He was, without question, that's the worst piece of legislation in my lifetime. I worked with welfare recipients for my entire career, and, you know, and used to do that kind of work with the welfare rights organization. I was a legal aid lawyer for years in Oakland and in California rural, and he did more damage to poor people in this country probably than any president in our lifetime, I think. And it's incredibly disappointing, you know.
Not to mention the CRI, the crime bill.
Yeah. No, you're right. You're absolutely right. I mean, it's, you know, I'm not a fan at all. I was still going through my fantasy world at that time, that, you know, maybe I could do. And I did some good things. I'm not going to understate. But the things we did that were good, we did without
always,
their support.
That's always true.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and it's a real struggle. I mean, someone is going to be, you know, someone's going to get the job, whether in the Department of Rehab or the Office for Civil Rights in the Department of, someone's going to have the job. So then the question is, you know, should somebody take it who's like not as bad a person? And I don't know. The whole problem with social change in this country is that, you know, you either are somebody who just is, you know, you're either going to do very incremental change, because that's the only way the system changes, or you're going to be a revolution, call yourself a revolutionary. But then the question is, well, what are you going to do? How are you going to perform your revolution? And it seems to me it's becoming harder and harder, and that's what's so distressing right now. I mean, so many people see the problem and define the problem, but then trying to figure out what the solution is and how you can sort of go forward. And, yeah, I have spent a couple of years in the system after fighting the system for many, many years. And it was horrible, too, because people yell at you. You know, if you're in the system, they think, you know, like you're a bad person because you're in the system. It's very, very difficult. You know, but you do, you know, sometimes you can help some people. And that's why people do it, you know.
Yes.
You know, you've worked with the regional center, for example, okay? You know, and my daughter, I have a daughter, she works for protection and advocacy, you know, in San Diego. They do some good stuff. You know, it's not going to change the world, but they help a few people. And so that's a good thing.
It does change the world.
Well, I hope it does. I hope it does. You know, we need a big change right now, Frank. I hope you get elected president. Because it doesn't look like the Democrats are going to come up with a candidate.
Will you be my MANA manager?
I'll be your campaign manager. I don't know anything about it, but if you get elected, you can put me on the U.S. Supreme Court. Or maybe Attorney General. I don't know how to manage a political campaign.
Everyone S.A. says that if you get elected, I'll take this
job.
You'll
give us a job. You're good. That's right.
But They can't help get you elected. When what is
What is that about? Yeah. I think a lot of us have just become so cynical about the whole system that we kind of think about, you know, if somebody's going to run for office, it's kind of like, oh, geez. You know?
H-E-I-M-O-U out of the B. I B O
B O X
box.
You're out of the box, right? And you'd be a great candidate for that reason, because you're completely out of the box, and you're a human being,
and
not a politician.
And I don't see a care.
Yeah. Well, maybe we can get you elected as a Democrat. You're gonna run as an you're running as an independent, right? Yeah, I know.
We've been calling it the Just Makes Sense Party.
Just Makes Sense Party. Okay, there you go. There you go.
But I am thinking of offering myself to the PEA Peace and Freedom Party.
All right. There you go. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I don't know much about them now. I knew about them way back.
Me too.
Yeah. That's probably a good idea, because they're going to be running somebody. Someone's going to run.
Right.
And probably should be you. You know, you have the vision, you know, you have a sense. You know, you're not in the box at all, and they're not in the, unless they've fallen into a box, they're not in the box at all. You know, either.
People who think they are not in the box sometimes are the M.O. most in the box.
That's the truth. That's the truth. Absolutely the truth. You know, and it's particularly true of politicians. You know, I'm sure even John Kerry didn't see himself in a box, but he clearly, you know, was in that box. And you know, it's unfortunate, because when you step out of the box, then you don't get elected. And the reason we need you to run for president or somebody is that people vote against their self-interest. It is amazing how people vote against their own self-interest time and time again.
Yes.
You know, people vote, you know, anti-consumer legislation, you know, and
never
we're all
understood
consumers.
That.
Never understood it. Well, I think people are indoctrinated. You know, people believe what they see on television. We had a proposition a couple of years ago. It was to basically change the law that made it easy for consumers who get ripped off to file a lawsuit. So they ran a whole campaign saying, oh, lawyers are getting rich, and stop the lawyers from getting rich. Well, these were not the lawyers who were getting rich doing these kinds of work. They were poverty lawyers, you know, representing poor people. And yet most people voted against their own self-interest. They made it now it's harder for you to sue if you buy a defective product or something like that. But people continuously do, because we're sort of brainwashed to think that, oh, yes, what these people are telling us is truth. And it's not truth. It's a bunch of BS. And we continuously do it. Women vote against abortion. I can't understand it. I mean, I have yet to meet a woman who doesn't want the right to choose. Yet you know, I don't know. I don't get it sometimes. I don't get it sometimes. But I think we're brainwashed. And I think we're brainwashed into believing, and it's been particularly serious since Reagan years, that it's okay to be selfish, and it's okay not to be communal, and it's okay to compete, because we all have a chance to win the lottery. But so we don't share anything.
What they see a call S E self, what they call self-interest, really a ain't self-interest.
That's right. That's right. You have a Congress that's supposed to support the American people, and yet they vote to give tax cuts to the richest 5% of the people. Well, where's that? You know, what do we? How do we make up that money that we could be putting into education or putting into jobs or putting into parks or putting into art or putting into music or, you know, I mean, it's just insane that we cut our own throats in a lot of ways. I mean, the parks were nicer when I was a kid than a lot of them are now in most communities. I mean, some communities, we're very fortunate here. I mean, that's one of the things. We live in a little... so different here than most of the rest of the country, you know. Mm-hmm.
I and no, the P O L I politicians H E here A C act U A, actually, C, O, come on this show.
Mm-hmm. You've had politicians on the show?
Well, we've had Chris Worthington on here a couple
right.
of times.
Berkeley City Council.
City Council.
Right.
And
I
then,
live in Oakland, so.
Right, and then the guy who ran for Berkeley mayor, Don Jelinek.
Oh, right,
he
yes,
was on
Don
here
Jelinek.
When he was when he was running for
okay.
mayor.
Okay, okay.
And... Amy Allison was
right.
on here
okay.
when she was running for her last
great.
Election.
Good, good.
Jesse Townley, who also ran for city council in Berkeley, he was
on
here.
Frank, do you try and ask them questions that they're gonna look bad from? I hope you do.
Oh, Don Jelinek. Yeah, you really. Frank really put him through the ringer.
You put him through the ringer,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah.
Now, there's somebody who's probably pretty, I don't really know the guy, so I can talk about him. Like, he does have a pretty good heart, but he's running for office, so he's going to, you know, he's going to pull that heart in a little bit because he wants to appeal to everybody.
And L I M I limit, limited. V I vision.
Right. Right. Limited vision. Yeah.
Six. What? When, where? Whereas K Chris Worthington has a vision. His
right.
has his vision.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
A Amy Allison, H, A, has vision, but is ambitious.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're ambitious and you have vision, those are conflicting, you know, things, unfortunately. You know.
S,
and,
so, she will not... come back on the show.
Okay. Yeah, I understand that. I mean, I think for the whole Berkeley myth is long over, as I think we all know. I mean, Berkeley has turned into, you know, three SUV driving families, you know, that have very, you know, and I mean, we've pushed most of the poor people out of Berkeley over the years. I mean, when I was looking for a home in the late 70s, I couldn't even afford to buy a house in Berkeley. I ended up in Oakland, which is fine. In fact, I'm very happy to be in Oakland because it's much more diverse now. But Berkeley has really changed. So if you have the vision, and your vision is anything like the vision used to be about what, you know, Berkeley was going to be and the popular mind about Berkeley, you know, I think still is. It's just not, it's not real any longer. I mean, it's, you know, fancy restaurants up near Chez Panisse. You know, it's in
W-H-I, which was what I W-A-R warned Don Jelinek about at that point, because it was, it, there was still, there were still some artists in Berkeley when he was running.
Sure. Who can afford to live in Berkeley if they're an art, if they, if they're an artist, and let's, you know, they're famous or something and making a lot of money.
A, he said, W, E, well, they can still come to Berkeley and do their art. And Frank said, but they won't be the voters anymore.
That's right.
The people
that's
that are going to be the voters are the people that can afford to shop at 4th Street shops and things like that.
And that's why,
and that's going to change
you had
the city.
You know, a pretty uninteresting mayor in Berkeley for many, 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 many years. And because the community had changed. And that's because, yeah, the artists are not the voters any longer. It's very disappointing. I'm hoping Oakland is gonna continue. We're having a little art resurgence in Oakland now. I don't know if you've sort of been down into Oakland, but they're doing a lot of interesting things down there. I understand they're closed. Once a month, they close off part of like Telegraph Avenue, and there's some new galleries down there. And it's young people, you know, kind of getting into art, and there's a few new clubs opening down there. I hope that's going to bloom a little bit, and it's going to kind of be, I mean, Berkeley is just, remember all the clubs in Berkeley, you know?
Yep.
You guys
did.
Like
performed
music.
In them.
You know, there you are. There you are, you know?
I even H, we had a club on San Pablo for the Blind Lemon.
I knew the Blind Lemon.
Yeah,
sure.
We owned that building for a while.
Oh, you owned that building?
Well, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, Jim owned it.
Jim owned it.
Frank wanted a theater, so Jim bought the theater, and then we paid rent to Jim, but rented as a club.
I remember that place.
Yeah.
I remember that place.
Yeah.
Oh, a whole lot of places. I mean, there's still a couple places left, but places that had new music. You know, where a lot of people went, like the Berkeley Square or the Keystone or the Long Branch.
Right.
I have to remember the Long Branch.
That's where we saw Patti Smith at the Long Branch.
Toots and the Maytals. I saw Toots and the Maytals at the Long Branch. Patti Smith. I was in Boston when Patti Smith was really
when
big.
E. D. D. Oh, Eddie Money opened for her.
Okay, Eddie Money opened for her. Well, he's still in Las Vegas. We could probably go see Eddie Money. I'm just guessing, but I think he probably is in Las Vegas.
Yeah, I think he is too. J.O., John, Kate, John, G, A,
Kale
was her piano player.
Really?
Yeah.
Patti Smith's group?
At the Long Branch?
Really? John Cale? Oh,
wow. Yeah.
That must have been awesome.
No.
That must have been great.
No. A. Audience.
No audience?
We were like right up front. It was when Rather Ripped Records was in the north side, and he brought her.
Right.
And Frank used to hang out at Rather Ripped Records, so that's how we kind of knew about the show.
Okay.
And we were like right up front.
Right.
And it was like, wow.
Yeah. And it was nobody there.
Yeah.
I saw so many bands in the Bay Area where nobody was there.
Yeah,
I saw the Fabulous Thunderbirds by myself once.
Wow.
One of the greatest blues bands of all time.
Wow.
You know, in fact, my friend Casey was with me, the two of us, and there was nobody there. And
V.
Yeah.
A. Van Morrison. When you saw Van Morrison. Was I with you for that one? Where was that? Where did we see Van Morrison? S. San Francisco.
He played at Winterland a couple times. I saw him at Winterland way back.
This was a old I Oldies R Review R E V I Revival Show.
Were they all dressed up in suits and smoking cigars and wearing hats?
No.
And a whole orchestra? Because I saw him do that once.
Oh,
no,
wow.
That was a different show. Seriously, I saw him do that.
Wow.
They were all dressed up. They had like tuxes and suits and hats, and they were smoking cigars.
D-
it was in Winterland.
S D R Doctor H O O K Dr. Hook.
And the medicine show.
C O U Country Country Joe.
Country Joe.
And no audience.
Yeah. Well, Country Joe, when he first started, had an audience, actually. I saw him at a big peace rally when I first got here in 1965. That's the first time I saw him. He had a jug band. It was a jug band at that time. He wasn't even really electric. And he had like a couple of little 45s that they were selling. But there were people out there screaming and yelling. It was an anti-war kind of thing. He got pretty big for a while. And then probably by the time he got to Berkeley, kind of. I remember I saw George Thorogood at the Starry Plow, which is right around the corner from where I live. I saw him during the afternoon. He was by him. The bar was empty. He played a Sunday show. And then he played a benefit at one of the great unknown clubs in Oakland, the Continental Club, which is still down in West Oakland. It's locked up. It's got a sprung dance floor like they used to have in like the 30s. And he did a benefit down there for a group. And then he went on to fame and fortune. But there's so many people who pass through Berkeley. I know you used to go to the Mabuhay. That's what Alexi told me.
We performed at the Mabuhay for 3.5 years.
Okay, and you performed there too. Okay.
We performed there every week for 3.5 years.
And I mean, there were so many places where you could see live entertainment. And it was affordable. It seemed affordable at the time. I don't know.
Right, we could afford it. We never had any money.
I never had any money either. But and I used to go out a lot.
And the S-T- The K. Keystone.
The Keystone. I love the Keystone. Oh, boy.
We
so many bands at the Keystone. I was there a lot, too. I'm sure I saw you guys. I remember I saw Talking Heads there when they first started. Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. Johnny Cash's daughter, Roseanne Cash, opened for Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
Wow.
Jerry Garcia Band.
We saw
Jerry Garcia Band there. Slenders. So many wonderful nights spent there.
Four T O Top. Oh, we saw the Four Tops.
The Four Tops. All right.
Jerry Lee Lewis.
Jerry Lee Lewis. Oh, wow.
R. Righteous Brothers.
The Righteous Brothers. I saw the Righteous Brothers.
R.I. Ricky Nelson.
Ricky Nelson. I never saw Ricky Nelson.
He was good.
I liked Ricky Nelson.
Yeah.
I liked Ricky. That was when we were kids. How old were you when you saw Ricky Nelson?
Well, we saw him in the 80s.
Oh,
right before he died.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
He was very good. He was like an hour and a half late
and
had a very pissed off audience.
Well, you know who's headlining the San Francisco Blues Festival this year? I go every year. Little Richard.
Oh, wow.
They got Little Richard.
Wow.
And most of the other performers are really blues people. They have Irma Thomas and a lot of New Orleans musicians this year. But yeah, there's some old timers who are still on the road.
The K E the Keystone. T. Tried to ban us.
Really?
This was in the 70s.
Your act?
No, just his audience people.
Oh.
They tried to This was before we were doing our show at the Mabuhay. And we used to there was like, there was 30 of us. There was a whole community, and we used to go together.
Right.
And we would just dance. So it wasn't like, you know, boy, girl. It was just like people dancing
people
with
dancing.
Each other.
Right.
And also,
I probably danced with you guys.
And we, you know, we would like really dance.
Because I used to go by myself a lot.
Yeah. And we always wore really colorful clothes and fun clothes.
Yeah.
And
you
so we
around.
Would be like, you know, we would be something to notice. And we befriended a lot of the musicians.
Right.
So Leela and the Snakes.
Oh, I remember
her. Perform there. We became friends with her. Country Porn. I don't know if you ever saw them. They were fantastic. They used to play there a lot.
I have not heard that for a long time. Okay.
Yeah. And the guy who was the manager there was that ex Hell's Angels blonde dude.
Yes.
And he told us that we weren't allowed to come unless we stood in the back and acted like everybody else. He waited until a night that it was just Frank and I to say that to
him. I used to sit in the front. I used to like to try to get there early and they sit right on the
seat. Yeah, we would always be right up front.
Yeah, then I jump into the front.
So what we did was Frank told everybody that
That's
we were
terrible.
All going to go.
Okay. Because
he waited till it was just Frank and I to say that. So we got everybody. We showed up.
Oh,
we went right
it.
In the front the way we always did. And we danced and he just stood there and watched and never said another word to us.
Well, you guys were paying to get in. I mean, that's the bottom line, right?
And L E. Leela and the Snakes, who was our friend at by that time, when we went to the dressing room and told her the first time we came back after he told us we couldn't come back.
What was her name?
Jane Dornacker.
Right.
So we
and
went
she
back.
She died, right?
Yeah, she
in,
died.
In a helicopter thing. And we had mutual friends, too.
Yes.
Jane Dornacker.
Yeah,
right.
We told her what happened, so she told him that she wouldn't go on stage if he gave us a hard time. So we had her standing up for us, too. So
she had been in a performance art group in San Francisco,
Leela and the Snakes.
Before there was
before
a Leela
that.
And the
right,
Snakes.
Right. The T. Tubes. She was involved
Tubes.
With the
okay.
Tubes.
Okay, yes, yes.
Yeah.
I loved her. She was wonderful.
Yeah.
I had forgotten her name, though.
She did the music for one of Frank's plays.
Oh.
Yeah, and she performed at one of the concerts Frank put on, a costume parade along the streets of Berkeley.
Oh.
It was a fantasy costume.
Do you have her in the mix anywhere?
Oh, yeah, of course we do.
I'd love to hear
rock
her
and roll,
again.
Rock and Roll Weirdos was our closing
rock
song at
Weirdos.
For years
That's
at
right.
the Major
Speed. I remember that.
Yeah, that was her song.
Oh, my goodness. I remember that band.
Yeah.
I liked them. They were good.
Yeah.
I had friends who were like writing this Maximum Rock and Roll magazine.
Oh, yeah. Well,
and Flipper was their
friends.
And some of the Kennedys, I think they were tight with those people. And I remember Crime and Nuns. And
opened for all of those bands.
All those bands,
Because we were the early show on Saturday night, so they all played.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. B. Black Flag was the roughest audience.
Black Flag. I remember Black Flag.
They intimidated our cast because they would scream and throw things, and the cast got intimidated. So Frank figured out what to do. He had us wheel him to front center of the stage, and he would just scream back at them as the show was going on.
The Black Flag was that muscle-bound guy, right?
The lead singer?
Yeah, who's the lead singer?
Who's the lead
Black
singer
Flag?
Of Black Flag?
He's
an actor now.
Yeah, he does like poetry kind of things.
Right.
Henry Rollins. Yeah, he's buff guy.
He's
like a bodybuilder with lots of tattoos.
It worked though. Frank's sitting on the stage. Boy, did they shut up!
I bet.
And they would just sit there, kind of looking at Frank like this.
Right. They had a great name. I love that name for a band though, Black Flag. That was like. Well, you know what it was? It was Pest.
Pest killer.
It was a pest thing. It was a pest killer.
Pesticide.
The pest killer. I loved X. X was my favorite Los Angeles band.
We opened for them many times.
They were sensational.
There, then.
They still are sensational, actually. They're still playing.
The Keystone. G. Guy. Started booking for the Berkeley Square.
Right. Okay.
Oh, no. What were you going to say? He started booking us. He booked us. Right. At the Keystone, right? Eventually, when we started our show years later, and then he booked us at the Keystone.
But the Berkeley Square went through two different. First, it was a jazz bar, and it actually had a big fireplace that people sat around. And actually, some very good jazz people came out of it. And then it turned into a rock and roll place. And I assume you guys had a rock
That's
and roll
when
stage.
We were involved. Yeah.
I saw the Replacements there and 10,000 Maniacs. And
we saw Robert Gordon there.
Robert Gordon. Yeah. Chili Peppers. When they
Red
first
Hot Chili Peppers.
Yeah, when they first started.
Uh-oh. H.
Not one of my favorite bands, by the way, but they were a whole different thing.
Hey. Well, our Chili Pepper story is, what's his name? From Flea from Chili Peppers.
Flea.
We found this out years later. Dirk, who ran the Mabuhay Garden,
Dirk. Yeah.
Told us that when Flea was a kid, and he used to play at the Mabuhay all the time in various bands, and Dirk would always feed the bands after their sound check, he'd feed them spaghetti. And our show would be the show that they'd be sitting there watching after their sound check. So Flea told Dirk years later, he was sitting there, he was like 14 years old at the time.
Mm-hmm.
He's sitting there eating his spaghetti and tripping on acid and watching our show. And then
that must have been fun.
And then the act, which we called the Meat Act, came on. Which was we had a band by that time. And so the band's playing Sympathy for the Devil and Frank's singing lead with Amy.
All right.
And then a hench person would come out, and various ones of us played that. But the hench person would be naked and then have these two monsters with them that were also naked but bloody with big teeth and stuff. And we'd stalk, and there was dry ice and strobe light going on. We'd stalk the audience for a victim. And we had a victim planted in the audience.
Okay.
And so we'd go around and we'd go to somebody and think about taking them. We finally get to our victim, and the victim starts screaming. We abduct the victim, dragging them, help, onto the stage. We had the stage all lined with plastic.
Oh, man.
They throw the victim down and tear the victim apart. Mm-hmm. And the victim is planted with chitlins and tomato sauce. And if it was a woman, they'd have a little doll in there.
Right.
And they'd eat them. This is all in the strobe while Frank's singing Sympathy for the Devil. But and then the hench person...
I got to get to your next show.
The hench person...
I was going to the ramen. I was ready.
The hench person resurrects the dead person.
Okay.
And so and then here we are all bloody and alive, and we sing a Sonny and Cher song, Somebody. And we're like swaying like this. It ain't power, it ain't freedom, but you got to have somebody. And that would be the end of the show. So he saw that.
Uh-huh.
And he told Dirk that it radically changed the direction of his art.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. All right.
I don't care. I don't know why. See? I L H A had a problem with me. He said he doesn't know why C I L had a problem with him.
I don't know either. I mean, they shouldn't have, but I know where they did. You were just years ahead of your time. You know, and unfortunately, you know, people like the Bill Graham organization were very much responsible for the end of, you know, so many of these clubs. I had friends that competed with him for years. But it was
Bill
impossible.
Bill Graham tried to get us to jump ship from the Mabuhay.
Yeah.
We were at a Werner Erhard, the guy who did We have a whole story about him. But anyway, we were invited.
I want to hear him speak once.
We were invited, for years to his big Christmas party where he'd rent out like the city, some big hall. And Bill Graham was there one year.
Oh, okay.
And so Bill Graham knew who we were because the Mabuhay was very popular. I mean, and Frank's show was very popular at the time. So he said that the thing that was keeping us down was our venue. And we needed to get out of the Mabuhay.
Right.
And Frank said, why, are you going to book me?
Yeah, right.
And he said, call my secretary or, you know, call. And,
I had friends who put on music in the Bay Area, but they got wiped out. I mean, they actually had Talking Heads and the B-52s on tour in Davis and Santa Cruz, but they could not get them anywhere right in the Bay Area because Bill Graham would pay him too much money. And he'd just pay him whatever they could, you know, to get these acts. And it pretty much killed off a lot of other attempts to put on interesting kinds of music. Yeah, and he wouldn't put you on, you know.
Right.
He did some good things, too. I mean, I'm not completely negative. But
I-T-R-A ran in to the T-A-L Talking Heads, performing a free concert on Sproul Plaza.
I saw the B-52s there, actually. The first time I saw the B-52s was a free concert at Sproul Plaza.
Yeah.
So I actually, they're doing free concerts again.
Oh.
So I went up there. It was about a month or two ago on a Friday afternoon. It was pretty terrible, though, and there was nobody there. But I'm sure when the Talking Heads were there, there were plenty of people. There were plenty of people for the B-52s.
But the, no, and the R. A. L. R. A. M. The Ramones. You saw the Ramones there too.
I saw the Ramones in front of City Hall in San Francisco the first time. No, seriously, in the park. Some radio station put them on.
That was where. Oh, that's where you saw them too in San Francisco.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then my friend put them on down in Santa Cruz. With, remember Roy Looney? That was another guy. Well, he never made it big. But he put on the Ramones. The one Bill Graham concert I'll never forget, though, and there's a lot of them, actually, but one I'll never forget was he put on The Clash at the Warfield, and he let them take out the first two rows so people could dance. And I had a seat in the third row, so I was in the first row. And, well, the Clash come out. I don't remember the opening act. There might have been one. I don't remember if there was one. Clash came out, and it was, like, completely insane. And the whole audience starts coming into the first row. And Bill Graham runs to the stage, and he's cursing, and he's going, I'm going to stop this show. And he's screaming, like, he's going crazy, you know, trying to keep everybody out, you know. It was hysterical. It was hysterical. But it was complete pandemonium and quite wonderful. And nobody ceased and desist. Everybody was in those first two rows jumping up and down.
When did D-A-N dancing B-E become T-taboo?
When did it become taboo, huh? It's really horrible. You go to a show and people say down in front.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, you know, like they can't see. Music is for, you know, expressing yourself.
We saw Eric Burdon. And
Wow.
Is that who you're talking about, that show?
Right.
This was in the suburbs someplace.
Uh-huh.
San Rafael.
Uh-huh.
Oh, well, no, I'm not talking about that. The San Rafael show was great.
Danville,
it was in
huh?
Danville. We liked him so much in San Rafael, we wanted to see him next
time
he came through.
Of course.
In San Rafael, there was nobody there.
Really?
We were in the front row again.
Right.
Talking to his band.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Why?
With Brian Auger playing with him.
Who?
Right.
Yeah. But then when we went to the Danville place,
uh-huh.
they actually said that you are not allowed to stand up, that it was like... You couldn't do it or you'd get booted.
Well, I went to this show, you know, that Chet Helms put on. He did a Summer of Love show in Golden Gate Park before he passed away. So it's about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And I got there early, so I was right up in front, and Wavy Gravy was the MC. And so there were all these people in the back telling the people in the front to get down. So I said to Wavy Gravy, I said, you got to tell those people that they got to get up. And he did.
Uh-huh.
And he did. He told everybody, he said, everybody in the back, get up. You know? Hey, that's what it is. It's music. I mean, that's what it's for. Although I have to say, I had a great experience with music. I went to the Greek Theater. I went last year, and I went this year to see this band called Widespread Panic. And I don't know if you've ever seen Widespread, going to see what, oh, you should go see them next time I come. They're really wonderful. They're not an indie band. They've been around a long time. But they're a jam band. And they're very, very good musicians. And everybody was up. They have real fans. They have people that follow them around. I mean, right. Like the dead, mm-hmm. You know. And the only difference is these are people who are employed. I mean, a lot of these people are like computer kids, and they follow this band around. But it was just like being there in 1965 and seeing the dead. Because everybody knew every song, and they were like all jumping around, and it was like insane. It was fun.
My, that is how it is S-U supposed to be.
That's right. That's right. Music, you know, there was a community in the Greek theater. I had a real feeling of community in the theater, you know, with all the people. And I don't know this band very well at all. And people come and say, I wonder if they're going to sing this song. Oh, well, I hope so. I was doing my best. But yeah, it was like community. Not and everybody was involved.
Want to look old, not wanting to look old. You pretended to know what they were talking about.
Well, it wasn't only being old, because you're right, I was the oldest person there. No, actually, that's not true. This is a band that does have a number of people who are... When I see Radiohead a few weeks before that, I was probably the oldest person there. But I don't care, because I love Radiohead. I think they're a great band, and I'm going to go see them. But it is true. You know, I wasn't so much feeling old. I didn't want to... I wanted to be part of the group, so I wanted to, you know, but... But they treat you well if you're old, actually. You know, like you're some sort of a statesperson or something. I don't know what it is. Yeah. They get out of your way so you can get up front.
Oh.
That's one advantage of being old.
Or a crip. That's what That's always it. Happens with Frank.
That's it. That's it. You and I could get in front of any show. There you go. There you go.
That is D.A. Dangerous in a punk club.
Yes.
at the slaughterhouse when we performed there, Frank was in the front. We ended up leaving when he got cut.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
right.
even though people were actually very protective of him, surprisingly, like the punks were all kind of trying to protect you,
but yeah, still, yeah. No, whenever I went to punk shows way back, I never got in front. I don't like to get bloodied. Right. To me, that's not part of the rock and roll experience. But it is for some kids. I mean, they burn off a lot of aggression, but no.
D-I-R. Dirk, P, U, put me on S on stage when L, E, N, Lenny, K, A, Y, E, Lenny K. Performed. Was this at the Mabuhay?
He put you up on the stage for your own safety.
right. Because K, N, O. Normally, we. A, S, A, sat in the front, in the back, in the Mabuhay, mm-hmm. Right, so.
Right, yeah, the front of the Mabuhay was not the place to be necessarily.
Animal bones flying, broken glass.
It's just too crazy.
Yeah, when. We first went there. Yeah, the first time we went there, one of the people in our group got hit by a broken bottle. So that was like...
Not cool. That's not cool.
That's when we stopped sitting in the front.
Yeah, I don't blame you. Yeah, well, you know, if you go to like a Grateful Dead show or something like that, it's a different crowd. So, right. You know, right. They say, excuse me, sir, you know, and they let you go to the front, you know. But yeah, you're right. There are certain kinds of shows where you don't want to be that close to the action. The first time I actually went to a punk show, it was at that converted synagogue near where the Fillmore is now. It used to be the People's Temple.
Right.
And it was a big punk show there with all of these bands. And I went with my friend who's my age, and he's a pretty strong guy. And I remember we walked in, and you know, we didn't know exactly what it was going to be, because these were all bands that I don't think they had records from. But let's go see this thing, you know. And this was before the Mabuhay. And I remember it was like nothing but slam dancing, and it was a pretty big place, and we were literally up against the back wall. It was like we were like back there, because they were like all over the place, and the bodies were going here and there. And of course, it was all young men, you know. Yeah. That's right. No, I don't think there were many women.
Yeah.
If they were, they certainly weren't doing that. But, yeah, it was rough back then.
F U N, funny, that, we, G, O, got, C, O, connected, M, two, P, U, N, K, to punk, that we, it's funny that we got connected to punk.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Oh, we were H I P hippies,
right?
Back at the Mabuhay,
right?
Yeah,
I was a hippie too.
Yeah. I mean, that we were, Frank was directing a play about strippers.
Okay.
So he got
right.
The three women that were playing the strippers' jobs
uh-huh.
at the diviest strip place we could find on Broadway.
Right.
Where they just danced to a jukebox,
uh-huh.
which would break all the time.
Right.
And so he wrote the characters based on, you know, types that
okay.
he had seen
okay.
at these strip places.
Okay.
So he got them a job. So we would have to hang out there, because he would, like, and it got real boring real
I
fast.
Bet.
So,
yeah.
like, they'd do their set, and then
sure.
he'd talk to them. They would do it as their character.
Right.
So he'd talk to them, and then we'd have to come back and whenever their next set
mm-hmm.
was. So we'd wander along Broadway. That's how we wandered into the Mabuhay.
Okay.
And that was when it was just getting started.
Right.
L.
But you like the music, I guess.
L. A. Oh, Leela and the Snakes, at that time was playing like a weekly gig
okay.
there. So we saw their picture, and that, you know, that was part of it. No. We were not into the music.
Mm-hmm.
Right, it was just a,
yeah.
I mean, it was just a
But it was a space where they would let you perform.
We went in there,
you know,
because
they were radical and so were you,
right.
and they weren't
Dirk.
Frightened.
Dirk,
yeah.
Frank
yeah,
asked him
yeah.
if Frank said, can I do a play here? He said,
right.
let me see the script you have.
Uh-huh.
And we showed him, it was a guy that had, Rick Foster, who had
mm-hmm.
like a hit play in San Francisco at
uh-huh.
the time, but he lived in Berkeley, and
okay.
he, Frank ran into him on the street and,
uh-huh.
and hit him up for a script. Said,
oh,
can
okay.
I direct one of your scripts? And he saw Frank as a cripple guy.
Uh-huh.
Oh, sure, Frank.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and he gives him
He had no
script.
Idea what you were going to do with it, did he?
He freaked out. He walked out during one of
not
the
a
rehearsals
clue, right?
and would not talk
to
us after that. He had no idea. But we showed Dirk the script.
Mm-hmm.
Frank, Dirk looks at it and he says,
yeah,
sure.
Sure, why not?
And he loved the play. He loved what Frank did with the play and offered us the venue to do whatever we wanted to. Oh, over the top. Right, what was it? It was about a pre-Christian Irish queen, Meb,
okay.
and
okay.
and her concubine.
Uh-huh.
And so Frank got this timber dude
uh-huh.
who wasn't, and most of the people weren't actors. They
mm-hmm.
were just people that crossed our paths
right.
and Frank would get into this play. And So the hero, the big hero, he had talking like this. My name is Kululin. And we macramed this completely see-through out of coarse a rope tunic thing he wore with smashed cans on it. And he wore those eyeglasses where the eyes pop out.
Right.
And most of the people had very little on it. So he didn't deviate at all from the words.
Right.
But it was just the way people played it.
The way you did it.
Yeah.
Right.
N, nudity.
Right.
V, I, O. V, I, O, E. V, I, O, violence, and eroticism.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And R, O, rock. Oh, right. We had rock music.
All
right. Right. Is that the one that Leela did? So that was the one Leela did, Jane Dornacker did the music for. And C, R, we had Crips playing just roles, you know, just any of the roles.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and it played, I think we had it for like 2 or 3 weekends. And, you know, nobody came, Dirk loved it. Dirk loved
right.
it. And he said, extend the run. But, you know, we couldn't because all these people had committed for that. So that's when he said, anything you want to do here,
you can do it.
You can do it.
That's great. Yeah. Oh, where are the Dirks? I mean, where are the, you know.
So then Diane, who was one of the construction workers with Jim, wanted to take some time off. And she said to Frank, can I do like some art project with you? So she didn't really have any ideas. So Frank said, I've always wanted to do a takeoff on a beauty contest. And she had like, you know, $100 or something.
Oh,
she
I
wanted
bet this
to
is
invest.
Great. I can see the gleam in Frank's eye.
So the $100 was going to be like the first prize.
All right.
So, but he wanted the criterion to be outrageous.
Right.
So it was going to be the outrageous beauty contest.
Why not?
And so we put posters, this was a time when you could get a listing in the Bay Guardian and places like that.
Sure, for free.
And asking for people to be contestants in this.
Right.
But he felt like nobody was outrageous enough, all these people coming through. So he decided to plant contestants. And he would tell contestants that there were plants.
Uh-huh.
But that they didn't know who the plants were, so they were competing against everybody.
I see.
So that was the way he raised the bar of outrageous. And
so who won?
Well, the thing is, we go to do this show, and we're used to doing shows where like 5 people show up.
Right.
There, it was beyond maximum.
Oh,
there
wow.
was like over 500
Great.
People there. There was standing room only. There were rows of press.
Uh-huh.
We were like the second page story in the Examiner.
Sensational.
And we got all this press. So Dirk runs backstage in the middle of the show and goes, make an announcement that it's a weekly show. And Frank being flexible. We were actually midway through rehearsals on Lysistrata.
But what you did is that it sounds like is you struck a note with an audience.
Right.
You know, and people say, like, come. You say to people who are, everybody's saying, don't come, go away. I don't want to deal with you. You said to all these outrageous people, come here.
Yeah,
We want to, you know, come here and be outrageous.
Yeah.
What a gift.
So we ended up doing it weekly then for 3.5
that's
years.
Great.
Yeah.
That is great.
Yeah.
I'm getting nostalgic talking to you folks.
You are giving L U lover your record collection.
Oh yes. I'm so excited about the abilities now to share music and allow other people to hear it and you've shared a little technology too with me, so that's been great. One of the things I really have wanted to do myself is listen to all my old music And now I'm beginning to do that because I hadn't pulled a record out in about 20 years. So I'm listening to my stuff, and you guys have such a wealth of music. And, you know, I was listening to your conversation with John Sinclair, you know, and, and all of a sudden he got, you know, like someone's incredible collection of, you know.
Well, when Frank said to him, can we have your music collection, we didn't realize he was going to pick up his laptop and
hand it to us. Yeah, right. Well, you got really lucky.
Yeah.
You got to work for my record collection. And you still haven't finished my tapes. But it's wonderful to be able to share music with other people and to be able to hear all your stuff.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to have to clone, you know, Mikey, though, because you're going to need somebody to start doing podcasts, and, you know, and I know he's too busy, but because you have so much stuff there now. I mean, it's just.
I mean, listening to Lover's Mix is like amazing. It's amazing.
So any way to contribute to that, and I hope people are listening to it. I mean, I hope people are listening.
Yeah.
I mean, the internet has just opened up the possibilities to be able to listen to music and, you know, take it out of the closet. I mean, it used to be a big deal to listen to music. You know, you'd sit there with your radio waiting for something.
Something good to come on.
Something I can listen to, you know, or, you know, just listening to your stuff over and over again. And
before we started Lover, we thought there was no more good music.
Yeah.
Because we turned the radio on and it was terrible.
That's what I thought to a certain extent, too. You know, before Lover, before podcasts, I really didn't have a clue. You know, in a way, what was going on musically, because there aren't the clubs anymore.
Right.
And you know, so I don't go out the way I used to. I'm older, too.
Right.
I don't stay up late anymore, really. Right. This is late for me. But tomorrow morning, I'm babysitting starting at 7:30 in the morning in Santa Rosa. Right. So this is late for me.
Right. But once we started Lover, all the CDs started coming in the mail.
That's right.
We're listening to it, and they're all great.
I know.
Yeah.
I mean, you shared some of that new music with me. Yeah. I mean, I never would have heard this music.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's so much being put out there.
Yeah.
And there are places where you can get wonderful new independent music. On, you know, like there's a guy who does like an R&B show back east, you know, every week. And he does a podcast. And it's all new bands. And it's, like George Thorogood, you know, people that play that kind of music and rockabilly. And there's a person who does a podcast out of Micronesia in Spanish. It's called Ritmo Latino. And this guy's in Micronesia. I think he's Anglo, but he speaks Spanish. And he does this show of Latin music all over the world.
Wow.
Who knew? Who knew? You know, it's not just Ricky Martin. I mean, it's other stuff, you know, because Ricky Martin is what you're going to see. I'm not against Ricky Martin. but you know what I'm saying?
There's more out there than Ricky Martin.
There's so much out there that you don't get to hear. And all these bands, you've given them a voice. You've given all of these bands, you know, an opportunity to be heard. And they wouldn't be heard otherwise. I never would have heard some of these bands if it were not for you. Never would have heard them. So I hope people are listening in. I do plug your mix.
Old bands that we're playing too. The stuff we never heard of,
Right. Absolutely right. I mean, you're getting.
That's what we're getting from people's collections.
I mean, you know a few songs for some of these records that people have accumulated over the years, but there's so many other songs and little gems, you know.
Yeah.
And the mix is so much fun, too.
Yeah.
Isn't it fun?
Yeah.
I mean, do you must just go walk.
You know what you
heard on the mix? You heard my daughter in junior high.
She was
on the mix.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
She made an album.
And you were listening when it played?
I didn't hear it, but Alexi heard.
Alexi heard it.
He came over and he said, "Are you responsible for these kids who are singing Gilbert and Sullivan?" Well, when my younger daughter, when she went to junior high in Berkeley, she's now like 36. When she went to junior high in Berkeley, they had a program in Gilbert and Sullivan where the kids learned the songs, and then they made a record, and then they went on tour with the record. They actually went and performed in other schools. And 1 year they went to Mexico. Anyway, so I had these records in my record collection. And
oh, when now they're part
and
of
I
the mix.
And I never looked at anything. I just gave you the record. You just got it. I didn't look at it. And it was dirty and flea-ridden,
oh,
I understand.
Great.
But it was, I just gave it over. I didn't look at it. And then, yeah, there's Robin singing on the mix, you
oh,
know.
Wow, wow, that's wonderful.
And you may pick her up with the San Francisco Girls Chorus later in her career as well. I think that's on
wonderful.
Tape, actually. You'll have to do the tapes. But, yeah, but there's all kinds of stuff. And
yeah.
There's so much stuff out there. And it's just so wonderful to be able to hear all these things.
They don't want us to know that.
That's right. That's right. They don't. Because they're selling product. I mean, they're selling product. And, you know, the freedom of the Internet is a big issue now. I mean, as I know you know.
And they see CONTR control ON only a fraction of what exists.
Right.
So they want us to think that's all there is.
That's right. That's right. They want us to see that little box, and is this whole world out there, and they're trying their best though to make it hard for Luber and you know, and all these independent websites, you know, and because people are terrified of the power of the web, and they're terrified because you're going to be able to get your message out for president without raising a whole lot of money or even going anywhere other than this room.
Right.
Because you're on the net.
Right.
And then once you're on the net, then the question is, you know, how do we get you, you know, talking to people, doing what you do,
is,
you know, out there.
Is he R E A L L really are running? That's what people
say.
Is he really running for president?
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, yeah, right. And your ability to do it without, I don't think you have millions of dollars. Maybe you do. No.
How much did it cost us to sign the domain name, which
right.
is $9?
Right.
That's all we
that,
put
there
into
you go.
It so far.
But your ability to do that and actually get some exposure is there. Is there because of the internet, and you know that's going to make for some very very interesting stuff coming up.
Oh, most people don't use the what's available, like the internet, for example, and public access television.
Right. Right. Well, public access television, as you know, is, you know, non-existent in most parts of the country. And
but in Berkeley,
in Berkeley, it is existent. Yes, I know. And I know you guys had some trouble with it, you know.
Yeah,
some
but
years
we
ago.
Fought and we won.
Yeah,
and
you fought and you
it's
won.
Still,
yeah.
It's really open.
Yeah.
There's no,
yeah.
You can put anything really on
right.
Berkeley.
I think most people, a lot of people don't know about it, or if they know about it, they just sort of dismiss it. They figure if nobody's going to watch it and.
I mean, Frank is constantly talking to guests who would
right.
complain about not being able to reach people, and he'll say, put a show on public access.
Right.
It's easy to
right.
do. And,
yeah, I think the public's view of it, because I can tell you what my own jaundiced view of it is living in Oakland. It's kind of like, do you want to watch the school board meeting? Mm. Now, there may very well be other things in Oakland. Mm. I don't know. And yeah. I think a lot of it is just simply ignorance. And it's the same thing with the web. I didn't know about Luver until I met Alexi. I didn't know about it. And part of it is that, you know, most people don't have a lot of time to play around and try to discover things. Mm-hmm. Now that I've had a little bit more time, I've discovered a whole bunch of neat things mm-hmm. on the net, you know, but people don't know about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the difficulty. People don't know what's available. I mean, if you wanted 50 Grateful Dead concerts on the mix, you can get them, right. you know, right. and right. tomorrow. Right. I mean, there's all kinds of things you can get. Right. And but people are not aware. So part of the question is, part of the problem is how to make people aware of these resources, you know. And that's what why you need a really professional manager for your campaign who can figure out a way. And I'll help to the extent that I can figure out ways to do things. But you need somebody who can figure out a way. How do you get whatever show it is you want that you're doing, you know, with someone you're interviewing or someone who's interviewing you because you're going to be a candidate. How do you get that? How do you get that out there? How do people know that Frank Moore is running for president? How do you get that out there? You know, I mean, things that occur to me is, you know.
There. This. Will. This will be on Radio for All, which is a resource
right.
Website that people that okay. do alternative news go to.
Okay. You put Amy Goodman on your website.
Yeah.
You need to get on hers, or maybe even better on the show. You know.
Amy Goodman would never have somebody like Frank on
is that
show.
Right?
I don't think
I
so.
I don't know her. I mean, yeah. I do listen to her, you know. Okay, yeah. All right. You're a little too outrageous for
yeah.
her.
Yeah, I think it's the old CIL syndrome.
How about the Move On people? How about the Move On people? Have you met them? They're even more conservative
yeah.
probably
yeah,
than,
yeah, 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 yeah.
than the Amy Goodmans of this
yeah.
world.
Yeah, I think
yeah,
so.
Yeah, I guess KPFA is kind of a... Yeah.
We are on KPFA yeah. on a regular basis, but... They T-R-I tried to K-I kick L-U lover off. Oh, out of. Now, what show was that they tried to get rid of lover? It was, there was a show at the Berkeley Community Theater,
uh-huh.
and we had gotten permission. Oh, it was the guy who makes the movies, Michael Moore.
Right.
He was speaking there, and we had gotten permission from his person to tape the show
uh-huh.
to play on Lover.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And luckily, Alexi and Corey brought the paper with them.
Oh,
and,
okay.
And the facts.
Right.
And KPFA, the guys from KPFA, they're taping it for their marathon, collect money
collect
thing.
Money. Yeah.
What are you doing here? We have exclusive rights to this. Well, they pull out their paper, and so they have to back off
you know,
and let us do it, which we play for free, of course, on BTV
yeah.
and on Lover.
Why can't people just work together? It's always struck me that the biggest problem that the left has is that we get so factionalized, mm-hmm. you know, into positions, into, you know, groups, into people with disabilities, women, black people. Why can't we just like work together? The bottom line is Lover stands for the same stuff that KPFA stands for and CIL. You know, you may have different ways that you want to approach
yes.
it.
Yes.
But your goals and your mission are no different.
Right.
I mean, I read your mission statement on your website, and that's one of the reasons I was really excited when you invited me. And I've been really excited to meet all you people after getting a sense of what you're trying to do as a community. But why don't these communities work together, for God's sakes?
The R I right do the
they
right
do.
The people
and
on the
they've
right
they've done it very effectively. They've worked together. They did their contract on America. They got all the foundations together. All the right-wing foundations, they work together, they have a strategy, you know, and they try to bury a little bit of their sectarian differences.
Right.
No, they do.
Yeah,
and that's
yeah,
one
yeah.
of the reasons that they've been winning. That's
right.
one of the reasons they've been winning.
Right.
You know?
Right. I'm actually yep. looking about the time. Are we over yet?
22.
Okay. So we have like about a minute. Will you... Oh, come back.
I would love to come back. And I forgot to bring you some more peppers. I was
going
to bring you guys
really
some more peppers.
Really enjoying those peppers.
I got some other peppers
for
you
wow,
guys to try.
Really fun.
Oh, good. Good. Really I grow peppers and,
wow.
and stuff. And I'd very much like to come back, and I'd like to, you know, But not just on the show. I'd like to kind of just, you know, come back and just BS with you some more. Because I really enjoyed tonight. I mean, I really enjoyed talking to all of you.
Yeah.
You know, this has been fun.
So, what did we T.A. talk about tonight? What did we talk about tonight?
Well, we did talk a little bit about we talked about everything tonight, didn't we? We talked about, in some ways, the world situation and...
Exactly.
We talked about everything.
I wanted to know what would we be talking about.
I did have an idea, you know. Well, and I'm glad we talked about music as well as talking about, you know, law and people with disabilities and all the rest. But it's all related, you know. And so we talked about humanity tonight and, you know, and how to make things a little bit better.
S-E. E, C, U, saying goodbye to everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.